The Katra Podcast, Conversations for the Curious, Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome back to the deep dive. Today, we're tackling a word you've probably heard, maybe seen pop up in some unexpected places, Kabbalah.
Yeah, you mentioned Kabbalah, and often the first thing that comes to mind is celebrities, red strings, maybe those sort of, you know, self-help guides.
Exactly. It's got this modern marketing sheen, hasn't it? Almost swamped by it.
It really has. And that popular image, well, it's miles away from what Kabbalah actually is, historically speaking. It's this incredibly profound, complex intellectual and religious force.
But deeply misunderstood, right?
Often, yes. Yeah. Revolutionary, even.
So that's our mission today. We want to try and cut through some of that noise. We're going deep into the history, the real complexity, the meaning of Kabbalah.
We're using a fantastic guide for this, the academic work of Joseph Dann. He really helps map it out.
Right, because Dann's work gives you that critical historical framework you need. It helps you, the learner, see past the surface.
Exactly. We're looking at Kabbalah not as some, you know, single ancient secret handed down unchanged, because it really wasn't that. It was this sophisticated, dynamic movement within Judaism that kept evolving.
Oh, yeah.
Adapting.
And why is the academic lens so important here? Why do we need Dann's perspective?
Well, because if you understand the authentic text-based wisdom, which is what we're trying to unpack, you can actually tell the difference
between the original spiritual achievement and
the modern stuff that, as Dann often pointed out, might use the words, the vocabulary, but kind of loses the core meaning. The essential content gets stripped away.
So we're looking for the source, not just the echo.
Precisely. And that starts with our guide, Joseph Dann himself.
Okay, so tell us about him.
Well, Joseph Dann was, I mean, truly one of the giants in this field. He held the Gershom Scholem Professor of Kabbalah Chair at Hebrew University, Jerusalem. That's a big deal.
That name, Gershom Scholem, rings a bell. He's foundational, isn't he?
Absolutely foundational. Yeah. Scholem basically created the modern critical academic study of Kabbalah back in the mid-20th century.
Yeah.
He treated it as history, not theology you had to believe in.
Okay, so Dann was Scholem's direct intellectual successor, carrying that torch.
Exactly. Carrying the torch of critical analysis, looking at the texts themselves.
And Dann's authority came from decades of really digging into the original Hebrew and Aramaic texts.
Decades. Meticulous research. Putting these mystical ideas into their proper historical, social, intellectual context.
Mm-hmm.
You know, rigorous stuff.
But that sounds like a potential tension, doesn't it?
Yeah.
How do you maintain scholarly objectivity, maybe even reveal a text isn't as old as people thought,
right,
while still appreciating the spiritual achievement of the people who created it?
That's actually the beauty of Dann's approach.
Yeah.
He wasn't trying to, like, be a Kabbalist or validate the mystical life itself. He was focused on showing us what Kabbalah is, historically, and crucially, how it redefined Jewish religious life over centuries. His goal was objective understanding, but with a deep appreciation for the sheer intellectual creativity involved.
Okay, that makes sense. So his central argument, then?
His core thesis, running through his work, is that Kabbalah is not one single, timeless, mystical system. It wasn't just handed down perfectly preserved.
Right. You said it evolved.
Exactly. It's a whole series of dynamic traditions. They kept adapting, responding to huge historical events, new philosophical ideas, social changes within Judaism.
So if it's always changing, what are the sort of the building blocks, the recurring concepts?
Well, Dann shows us the core toolkit they used, you could say, to try and grasp the infinite God. First, you have the idea of God's hidden, infinite essence, the Ein Sof, completely beyond our understanding.
Okay, infinite, beyond comprehension. So how does that connect to us, to the world?
Ah, that's the crucial question. And the answer, the mechanism, is the Sephirot.
The Sephirot, heard that term.
These are the 10 divine emanations. Think of them like attributes, or maybe channels, or dimensions of God's presence that structure the cosmos.
Sort of like lenses, filtering the infinite light of the Ein Sof.
That's a great way to put it. Lenses that make the infinite accessible, structured, dynamic.
And then there's this whole cosmic drama involved too, isn't there? Something about shattering and fixing.
Yes, absolutely. The Shavira, the breaking, the cosmic rupture. And then humanity's role in tikkun, the mending, the restoration.
Right.
And Dann insists really strongly that you can't understand these mystical ideas in a vacuum. They're deeply tied to Jewish religious law, halakha, and to the actual events of Jewish history. Mysticism and practice were woven together.
Okay, let's trace that evolution then. Where does Dan start the story?
He takes us way back, before what we usually call Kabbalah even existed, to the early foundations, maybe 1st, 10th century CE. We're talking Merkaba mysticism.
Merkaba, the chariot,
yeah,
like in the Bible.
Exactly. Rooted in Ezekiel's vision of the divine chariot. This early stuff was very visionary, ecstatic, focused on the experience.
So what kind of experience?
Practitioners aimed for this inner ascent, climbing through seven heavenly palaces, the Hekhelet, to try and behold the divine throne. It was about mystical journeys.
Wow. Okay. And alongside that?
There's this other really crucial, cryptic early text, the Sefer Yetzirah, the Book of Formation. Probably early medieval.
Book of Formation. What's the core idea there?
It introduces this radical idea that the 22 Hebrew letters and 10 primordial numbers, maybe an early version of the Sephiroth, aren't just symbols. They are the actual building blocks of creation.
So language and number have cosmic power.
Exactly. They create. It's a foundational text for later Kabbalah.
Okay, so that's the early mystical groundwork. But when does Kabbalah, as we sort of picture it, the structured system actually emerge?
That happens much later. 12th, 13th centuries, mainly in Provence, southern France, and then Spain. This is the birth of classical Kabbalah.
And this is where the Zohar comes in, the Book of Splendor.
This is absolutely where the Zohar explodes onto the scene. It becomes the canonical text. Hugely influential.
But here's where Dan's academic side gets really interesting, right? The Zohar's origins aren't quite what they seem.
Right. The scholarly consensus, which Dan definitely supports, is that the Zohar is pseudepigraphic.
Pseudepigraphic. Okay, break that down for us. Sounds important.
It just means it was written under a false name, basically.
Yeah.
Attributed to someone famous from long ago to give it more authority.
So who actually wrote it?
It seems to have been composed by a circle of Kabbalists in 13th century Spain, with Moses de Leon being the most likely main author. But they attributed it to this legendary sage from the 2nd century, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai.
Why do that? Why pretend it's ancient?
To gain legitimacy. They were making some pretty revolutionary theological statements.
Yeah.
Framing it as ancient wisdom made it much harder to dismiss. It was a strategic move.
Clever. And what was so revolutionary about the Zohar's message? Why did it catch on?
Well, think about the context. You had figures like Maimonides, the great rationalist philosopher,
right,
describing God as pure, abstract intellect, very distant, very detached.
Right.
The Zohar offered this incredibly rich, mythological counter-narrative. It depicted the divine world, the world of the Sephiroth, as this dynamic, dramatic, almost personal realm, full of life, tension, even gendered aspects.
Gendered aspects, like male and female.
Yes, particularly the concept of the Shekinah, the feminine indwelling presence of God, who was seen as sharing Israel's suffering in exile. It made God feel much more immediate, more involved in the world's fate.
That idea of exile, that must have become incredibly powerful later on.
Hugely powerful, especially after the catastrophe of the Spanish expulsion in 1492.
Yeah.
That was a massive trauma for the Jewish world.
Shook everything up.
Totally. And that trauma really sets the stage for the next major transformation in Kabbalah, the Lurianic Revolution.
Lurianic, named after someone.
Named after Rabbi Isaac Luria, known as the Ari the Lion. He was active in the town of Seyfit in Ottoman Palestine in the 16th century. A mystical renaissance happened there.
And his system was a direct response to the expulsion.
Very much so. It was this incredibly creative, complex, theological response to that disaster. Luria formulated this grand cosmic drama in basically three acts. It explained not just Jewish suffering, but why the whole cosmos seemed broken.
Okay, Act One, you mentioned something radical.
Act One is Zimzum, contraction. This is maybe the most mind-bending idea. Before anything could be created, the infinite God, the Ein Sof, had to somehow withdraw, contract itself from a single point to make conceptual space for a finite world to exist.
God had to shrink, make room.
In a metaphorical sense, yes. A kind of divine self-limitation. God actively pulled back, dimmed the light to allow something other than God to emerge.
Wow. Okay, so that creates a space, a kind of void.
And then God's light rushes into that space to form the vessels, the Sephiroth. But and this is Act Two, the vessels weren't strong enough, the light was too intense, they shattered. Shivirat HaKilim, the shattering of the vessels. And when they broke, divine sparks of holiness scattered everywhere, falling down into the lower realms, the material world.
And these sparks got trapped.
Exactly. Yeah. Trapped within the broken shards, the husks, called Klippot. And for Luria and his followers, this is the origin of evil, chaos, the fundamental brokenness of existence. It's not just a human problem, it's cosmic.
That sounds pretty bleak. Is there a way out?
Yes. That's Act Three. Tikkun, restoration, mending.
And How does that happen? Who does the mending?
We do, humanity. According to Luria, we have this messianic task. By performing the commandments, the mitzvot, but with the correct mystical intention, Kavanaugh, we can actually liberate those trapped sparks.
So our actions, they lift the sparks back up.
Precisely. Each good deed done with the right focus helps gather the light, heal the divine structure, and ultimately restore cosmic harmony. Luria basically turned Jewish exile from just a punishment into this vital global cosmic mission. Everyone had a role to play in fixing the universe.
That's a huge shift in perspective. But Luria's system sounds incredibly complex, maybe only for snollers.
It was very complex, often passed down orally in elite circles. But the next major phase really democratized these ideas.
Okay, where are we now?
We're moving to 18th century Eastern Europe with the rise of Hasidism, founded by the figure known as the Baal Shem Tov.
Hasidism? Okay, I've heard of that. How did they change things?
The Hasidic masters were brilliant at adapting these intricate Lurianic concepts for, well, for the masses.
Yeah.
For ordinary people.
Oh, they do that.
The key shift was internalization. They taught that the whole cosmic drama, the Sephirot, the shattering, the tikkun, wasn't just happening out there in the cosmos. It was also happening inside the human soul.
Ah, so the macrocosm mirrored in the microcosm.
Exactly. Your own inner life reflects the divine drama. And this shifted the focus. It wasn't just about complex rituals anymore.
And what's it about then?
It was about achieving Devekut, this idea of cleaving or communion with God in every moment, in daily life, finding the divine sparks in everything you do.
So less about intense study and more about feeling, experience.
Yes, and emphasizing joy, enthusiasm, emotional connection over, say, asceticism. It made Luria's grand vision feel much more practical, personal, and accessible for everyone.
What an incredible journey from chariot visions to cosmic repair to inner communion.
It really is. And tracing that evolution, Dan helps us see some really crucial underlying themes.
Okay, let's pull those out. What's the first big takeaway?
Theme one is just starkly obvious from the history, historical evolution versus static wisdom.
Right. Kabbalah wasn't this fixed ancient thing. It kept changing.
Dramatically.
Yeah.
It responded to trauma like the expulsion. It grappled with rationalist philosophy. It adapted to the need for popular spirituality. It was alive.
And the reflection for us.
Well, it encourages you to maybe see all major belief systems, not just as museum pieces, but as potentially adaptable living things that respond to history.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay, theme two.
Theme two is this potent combination of theosophy and theurgy.
Theosophy, knowing God.
Right. Mapping the divine world, understanding the Sivero. But theurgy means influencing God, acting upon the divine realm.
Wait, humans influencing God, that sounds bold. How do they square that with traditional Jewish thought?
It is bold. Their argument was that since the divine structure itself was, in a sense, fractured by the Shavira, human action, specifically performing mitzvot with the right kavana, could literally help heal and unify God's own emanations.
So your choices, your actions have cosmic consequences.
Directly. You're not just following rules. You're actively participating in the restoration of the universe. It gives everyday ethics and ritual this profound transcendent weight. Your actions really matter on a cosmic scale.
That's powerful. Okay, and the third theme?
Theme three is Kabbalah as a mythical counter-narrative.
Counter to what?
Counter to that cool, abstract, rationalist philosophy like Maimonides we mentioned. The Kabbalists consciously chose to use rich, dramatic, symbolic, mythic language.
Like the Sephirot map, the Shaken.
Exactly. They use story, metaphor, personification, drama. Why?
Yeah.
Because they were tackling deep existential questions, the nature of evil, the reason for suffering, the relationship between the infinite and the finite.
Questions that pure logic maybe can't answer.
Precisely. Questions that seem to require metaphor, art, myth to even approach. Mm-hmm. It's a powerful reminder for us today maybe to value those ways of knowing, not just data and pure reason.
Yeah, absolutely. So Dan's work, being academic, probably boils down some key insights or concise statements.
Definitely. His writings are full of these sharp summaries that really capture his perspective, cutting through the noise.
Let's hear a few of those core ideas, maybe paraphrased.
Okay, first, Dan would stress something like, Kabbalah is not a single unified doctrine, but rather a collection of diverse mystical movements and literary traditions.
Mm, that emphasizes the diversity we've been talking about.
Right, no one monolithic thing. What else?
Thinking about Luria. Lurianic Kabbalah transformed the meaning of Jewish exile. It was no longer simply a punishment for sin, but a cosmic mission. That reframing of suffering is huge, giving purpose to hardship.
Yeah.
Third, about its relationship to Judaism overall. The Kabbalists did not seek to replace Jewish law, but to transform it from within through mystical consciousness. Integration, not replacement.
So mysticism enriching practice, not ditching it.
Exactly. And maybe a final crucial one for today, his critique. Modern popularizations of Kabbalah often preserve the vocabulary while losing the essential content of the mystical tradition.
Oof, that's pretty direct. Basically, the words are there, but the deep meaning, the context, the obligations, they're gone.
That was definitely his concern. You lose the intricate theology, the connection to Jewish life and history.
So thinking about applying this, how can Dan's historical approach help us practically?
Well, application one is right there in that critique. Critical thinking and authenticity.
How so?
Dan's historical method gives you, the learner, a toolkit. When you encounter any spiritual movement, especially one claiming ancient roots, you can ask critical questions.
Like, what are the actual historical origins? Who's teaching this? What's been changed or removed?
Mm-hmm.
If someone takes Kabbalah, removes the Jewish law, the history, the specific context, what's really left? Does it still hold its original integrity?
It's about discernment, vetting the claims.
Exactly. And application two comes from that Lurianic idea of tikkun, finding meaning in brokenness.
Ah, right. The idea that the world is fundamentally broken, but that's where our work lies.
Yes. The concept that creation itself involved a shavira, a shattering, is profound. It suggests that brokenness, personal, collective, cosmic, isn't necessarily a sign of failure.
It's the starting point.
It's the precondition for meaningful action, for repair. It offers this incredible psychological framework for resilience. Our task in a flawed world isn't to despair, but to actively engage in tikkun, in mending.
Every small act of kindness, of justice, of performing a mitzvah with intention, it's retrieving a spark.
That's the Lurianic vision. You are actively participating in healing the world.
So reflecting on all this, what was the most surprising thing for you digging into Dan's perspective?
For me, I think it's always that point about the Zohar. The rigorous academic confirmation that this foundational text was actually a medieval creation, strategically presented as ancient.
Yeah, that's pretty mind-blowing.
It just shows the incredible power of human creativity, even theological innovation, hiding in plain sight.
Yeah.
And how scholarship can carefully peel back those layers. It doesn't diminish the Zohar's importance, but it reveals the human genius behind it.
That's a great point. For me, the lasting insight, maybe the most valuable lesson from Dan, is how essential historical understanding is for any kind of authentic spiritual or religious appreciation.
Hmm.
That rigorous study, the kind Dan championed, doesn't have to kill the magic. In fact, it can deepen your appreciation for what an incredible, complex human achievement something like Kabbalah really is. It's not just some vague ancient secret.
It's a testament to centuries of grappling with the biggest questions, constantly creating new meaning out of tradition and trauma. A historical and intellectual masterpiece, really.
Couldn't agree more. A truly fascinating deep dive. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.